You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. Oh, Don, I'm going to be able to say that for months now.
You can probably say that through June, July, August, and September. We might get a cloud in the sky occasionally during that period, but almost certainly no rain until perhaps October. It is gorgeous, sunny, clear right now. Lois and I are preparing the show on May 29, 2024 for broadcast on May 30. 2024. It's 72 degrees right now, at least at the Sacramento Executive Airport, going up to a high today of 87 degrees, which is roughly where it was yesterday, a little warmer than it was yesterday. North wind right now to 10 miles an hour. Humidity before noon is already only 37%, dropping to a low probably below 20% today. Fairly typical late spring, early summer pattern. Thursday, the day of the broadcast, will be 93 degrees, and I think that's the first day in the 90s we've had in weeks. And then Thursday night will be 58 degrees, mostly clear. Friday, 92 degrees. A lot of variation on weather apps and such right now. I'm giving you the National Weather Service forecast based in West Sacramento, which is not far from East Davis. But others on Weather Underground and some of the other sites are seeing high temperatures anywhere from 2 to 5 degrees higher than this. So keep that in mind. When the north wind blows, the day after it blows, it gets still, and that's going to be a hot day, relatively speaking. And those are going to be 93, 92 Thursday and Friday. And then according to the Weather Service for the Davis area, Saturday will be 86 degrees and sunny. Saturday night will be 54 degrees and mostly clear. Sunday will be 86 and sunny. Sunday night, 58. Monday, warming trend for early next week. Monday, 90. Monday night, 61. Tuesday, Weather Service is showing 95. I know a couple of the other weather apps have shown closer to 100, and other parts of the valley as you go further interior and up and down the valley will be perhaps 100 degrees or a little bit more. I think that's the first we've had this season of temperatures in that range. And as much as people are going to complain about it, our gardens kind of need this. Okay. All those summer vegetables you all like to plant have not been real happy about the night temperatures and the cooler conditions. They're finally really, really beginning to take off. I've actually been waiting for temperatures in the 90s to get out there and plant my watermelons, my okra, and some of those other real heat lovers, and the pumpkins and the winter squash will be going in shortly as well. What do you think is the most common question we're getting at our garden center right now?
Is it time to plant tomatoes?
Is it too late to plant tomatoes? Is it too early to plant this, that, or the other? Most of our questions have been about timing right now. And just to, in a nutshell, you can certainly still plant tomatoes, peppers, eggplant, zucchini, cucumbers, all that kind of stuff. They're fine to go in now. Obviously, keep a close watch on the watering. I probably wouldn't plant in the middle of a gusty north wind, but I wouldn't hesitate to plant the next day when things are more still so the plant won't desiccate as quickly. I'm not concerned about the temperature. I'm more concerned about the humidity and the wind when I'm planting little seedlings out. I've got a number of things still to go in the ground. Bear in mind, our season goes all the way through September, definitely. Well into October, typically. You can count on summer-like conditions here until about the second week of October very consistently. And let's say early girl tomato. You plant an early girl tomato June 1. It takes about 2 weeks to root in, get going, get growing, get blooming. That bloom has a ripe fruit about 50 days later, so roughly 2 months later. So June 1, July 1. August, you're picking that on September 1. We can pick fruit here all the way through September, and my biggest harvests of tomatoes, and especially peppers, are in the month of October. Generally, the first and second weeks of October, my kitchen is a solid mess of tomatoes and peppers being processed, because that's the maximum harvest, and those are fruit that set in July or August, or even as late as the 1st of September, depending on what it is. Cucumbers are only 30 to 40 days from planting. So you can continue to plant cucumbers, and I've done this, all the way into the 1st of August. You're not going to find them in garden centers, but you can continue to plant them through the middle of the summer here and get good yields on them. So all those summer vegetables, you've still got plenty of time. If you're thinking of doing winter squash or pumpkins, generally speaking, they're planted about the 1st of June, and for the jack-o'-lantern market, pumpkins are planted about July 1. So you can plant all the way through the month of June on all of those types of real heat-loving summer vegetables that are going to be producing late in the summer or even into early fall. I know there's a lot of you perhaps listening in places where your season ends around Labor Day or where September really feels more fall-like, but here in Northern California and also especially interior Southern California, our summer vegetable garden season goes all the way through the month of September, and I've never had a year here where that wasn't the case. It's not like we get cold early. It's not like we get rain early. We've had fluke phenomena, such as a heavy rainfall in September one year, but it just warmed right up after that and everything was fine. And so we have a long season. We've still got plenty of time to plant. The other questions we're getting, though, they're mostly novice gardeners, or at least new to this area, are about things like leafy greens, lettuce, kale, things like cilantro. Those do not
like your garden.
Those are cool season plants. Yeah, the question just popped up. Why does my cilantro always flower? Well, honestly, the answer is because you're planting at the wrong time of year for this climate. You can only plant cilantro here if you happen to be a fan of it in September, October, or maybe February, March. You can plant it through midwinter, but it won't do a whole lot in the very, very cold weather. But once it warms up at all, it'll just trigger to bloom. And next thing you know, you have flowers and seeds, coriander, that's fine. You can use that, but that's probably not what you were growing it for. Don't fear, if your cilantro blooms, it's very attractive to beneficial insects. So that's cool. But you know, sticking a cilantro in the ground in April is generally disappointing.
So is cilantro something that you can grow indoors in your kitchen window?
That's just a firm no. People ask that all the time. That was the second
question. I just want to make sure.
Yeah, no, that's a reasonable question. They're kind of wondering, is it the temperature or what is it? No, it's not an indoor plant. You don't have enough light indoors. I suppose you could grow it under lights if you were so inclined. But no, it just doesn't work that way. You just basically time it for those cooler, moderate times of year. Beginning of fall. And by the way, it's not frost sensitive. So if you plant it in September, October, you can probably be harvesting that plant right on through the winter. It just doesn't grow much in the depth of December and January. And then the second time to plant is late February and March, and then you'll harvest that before it warms up. So it's a pretty disappointing plant if you put it in the month of April.
Is there something other than cilantro? Like, is there some kind of parsley that will grow in the summer?
Yeah, parsley is a biennial. Parsley you plant any time and it grows right on through the entire year and flowers the next year. So that's a plant you can plant pretty much any time of year. It's not comparable to cilantro. I don't think it's used the same, but it's, you know, there's lots of those leafy herbs like that that you can plant now with no problem. Obviously, right now is when we plant basil, for example. But cilantro has its own special following, and people are often disappointed when they move here from the Bay Area or coastal Southern California, where you can grow it pretty much year round. It's definitely a seasonal crop here. And the leafy greens, this is the one that keeps coming up. You know, they go over to our seed rack and there's no lettuce or kale or anything on there. At our nursery, we pull those off when it's not time to plant them. So if you are looking at our seed rack at our nursery, and I believe we're pretty unique in this regard, if it isn't time to plant it, it's not on the rack. It's in a box on the ground. So you're welcome to buy the seeds if you want to. But I figure if it's on the rack, people think, oh, it's time to plant this. So we adjust our seed rack as the season goes along. We pull the things that are too late to plant or inappropriate to plant. They're nearby. You want to buy some lettuce seed, I can probably find a packet and sell it to you. But over many years of having everything on the seed rack, people coming up to the counter and plopping things down, I'm going, okay, peas, lettuce, we plant these in the fall, beans, this we plant now, and they, oh, well, then I don't want to buy those if it's, you know, not time to plant them. So we saved ourselves and them some trouble and disappointment.
I want, for people who are listening and thinking, oh, I'll go to Dunn's store and then I'll know what's for growing this summer. Mm-hmm. Understand that the most popular things on that seed rack get sold out.
Yes, that's been a problem this year.
I was in there to find a particular thing and then there's nothing there. And I'm going, but it's the right time of year. Well, then yeah.
We're still dealing with inventory issues in the seed industry. I go all the way back to the beginning of the pandemic. I have two seed suppliers now, and one of them, I was going to do a reorder and 50% of the things on their list were out of stock. So I shifted over to the other seed vendor. So, but most places, most seed racks you look at, The seed company has a sales rep who brings in the entire year's supply of seeds. These companies are back east, and so they don't know about California having a, you know, two full gardening seasons. They ship everything out for the year. That includes all the kale and lettuce and broccoli, and includes all of the peppers and tomatoes and beans and squash. And they're all on the rack at most those places you go. And so you have to use your judgment about what is to be planted now. And also the packet itself is not a good source of information, because they print these packets for the entire country. So I hear people standing over there talking to each other saying, it says here plant 6 weeks after danger of frost has passed. Oh, sorry, excuse me, ignore the seed packet. Listen to us. I hate to do this, but that's not something we plant now. That's one of the reasons I pulled them from our seed rack, is that the packet itself, you think about this as an exercise. You're going to write a seed packet with instructions that are going to be read in Alaska, Minnesota, California, Georgia, and New York. What is that packet going to say about planting?
And Puerto Rico.
Exactly. It could be any Hawaii. There you go.
Okay, so before we get off of this seed packet thing, I found someone to help me in the yard, thank goodness.
Yes.
And he got a lot of those weeds out of there and the grass, and it was wonderful. He got a little enthusiastic and raked up everything, because he didn't want to have anything left that could reseed. Well, you know, whatever. So I now have patches of bare dirt. And I'm going, ooh, I could plant California poppies because they like bare dirt. I wonder what else I could plant. Oh, I have a bag full of Nigella seeds. Oh, love and a miss. That would be a fun thing. So I walked into Don's store yesterday and said, this is the situation. What can I plant? And he told me about a bunch of different things that one could plant now, scattering seeds and planting it. And then we talked a little bit about wildflower seeds. And if I have gone to many places other than his store and seen packets of wildflower seeds, or California wildflower seeds, yeah, or meadow seeds, or, you know, all sorts of stuff like that. And if you look at it, I suppose some of those flowers are wild somewhere, but to my mind, a sweet alyssum is a garden flower. Yeah,
not native to California, no. No, this is an extraordinary frustration for those of us in retail. There's things called wildflower seed. The wildflower seeds are very popular right now, along with native plants. That's really cool. Generally speaking, in California, we scatter wildflower seeds in the fall, right before the rainy season. But if you throw out California poppy seeds now, they might come up, or they might just lie there and wait until the rains begin.
I'm going to water, Don. Okay,
they'll probably come up. But when I would go as a retailer to try and find a wildflower mix to put out for my customers, I would always go to the website and look at what's in them, and they'll have things like cosmos. Here's my favorite, African daisy. Now,
wait a minute.
There's a hint, but that might not be a California native. Just the name alone should be a hint, right? So it is common for those larger seed companies that are making blends that they're calling wildflower mixes to throw things in there that grow easily and are going to ensure success, but aren't really wildflowers. And I've just stopped selling those. As far as I'm concerned, calling it a wildflower mix if they're not actually wildflowers is a little, I'd say misleading is a good term for it. So I embarked on the process of trying to find a Central Valley wildflower mix. Now, you all listening, wherever you are, can find these things by going to specialty nursery or seed suppliers, like the Theodore Payne Foundation is a good example. They sell packets. They're fairly expensive. They're not selling wholesale, but they sell packets, regionally appropriate wildflower mixes for the Central Valley, for the North Coast, and so forth. We found a supplier who does that in bulk. And so we bought in bulk Central Valley wildflower mix. I hooked up every one of them to make sure they actually were native, to make sure this company was reputable. And they're all native to the Central Valley. That includes lupins and California poppies and tidy tips and things like that. And so we bought that in and portioned them out and made our own packets of Central Valley wildflower mix. If you're listening on the coast, there are North Coast mixes and so forth. Just buying wildflower mixes off a national brand seed rack is not going to be very satisfactory if you really want to have native wildflowers. So that's the first thing. Look at the label, try to find out what's in there. And more to the point, go to a place that is reputably getting actual native wildflower seeds. Mm-hmm. We should mention one thing. KDRT is commercial radio. It's public radio. We rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. If you like what you hear, if you want to give us some money, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. And there are all kinds of great programs at KDRT. There's a lot of music programs, but there are what we call public affairs programs, which is where they talk about stuff. Ion Sports is a talk radio show focused on local sports in the Sacramento Davis area. It occasionally covers national sports. Hosts Chuck and Cody have been involved with sporting both nationally and locally for more than 15 years. They want to share their opinions and initiate discussion to the public through conversation and occasional outside interviews. This show will not be politically driven in any way. Conversation will cover the results, local impact, business, and psychology of sports. Their goal is to create a lighthearted, focused conversation on everything sports related. That's live Thursdays, 6 to 7 p.m. For the rebroadcast time of any of the programming on KDRT, just click on the schedule guide.
Isn't it amazing that we have shows that are specific to some things like sports, and then other shows that are very broad, and it's all here. It's all at KDRT.
There's something like 30 different programmers putting together almost every week an original show for you to listen to, whether it's music or public affairs or one of them, Peter Pastore, brings musicians into the studio. They talk about their music and they play right there in the studio. So there's a lot of amazing programming. Just go ahead and click on the schedule guide. You'll find a link to all the different programs here at KDRT. Also, KDRT does a lot of things out in the community, and we have a KDRT alert. You can join Davis Media Access and KDRT as they broadcast live from the 2024 Davis Pride Celebration that's happening at Civic Center Park at 6th and B Streets Saturday, June 1, beginning at 10:30 a.m. And if you can't be at Civic Center Park, you can listen live on KDRT 95.7 FM, kdrt.org, just as you are right now. And if you're down there, wave at Autumn. The staff will be down there broadcasting live from Davis Pride Celebration 2024.
Don, I have a problem. 6th and B, that's over by the Senior Center.
I guess so.
I don't think there's a park there.
Well, I'm just reading what was put in front of me.
I don't know where Civic Center Park is, but you'll find it.
You'll find them. There's lots of bells. There's going to be a huge turnout for this. You'll find it.
Center, that's got to be like the City Hall.
Yeah,
so maybe it's that playing field behind City Hall between there and the sea. Who knows?
Look for a large group of people and listen for the music. Look for a radio broadcasting and say hi to Autumn. Okay.
Sounds good.
All right.
Well, this is the last week of May, and I realize that I have been shirking my duty and I haven't been going through the May calendar. So I'm going to read off the names of the flowers on the May calendar real quick.
Now, remember, these are the pictures that I actually took at some point in the month of May. So the idea being, and I also curate them a little bit to the extent that they're things that would typically be blooming in the month of May.
Okay, Alstroemeria, Buddleia, Rosa Betty Boop, Salvia oleaginosa, Mimulus, Water Lily, Rosa Brandy, Canna tropicana, Gaillardia, Achillea, Celosia, and Hemerocallis. Don, that's daylily. Why do you call it Hemerocallis?
Why do I call it Hemerocallis? Because common names can be misleading and confusing. Oh. And we've discussed many examples of that before, but just the word lily. It's part of the name daylily. I don't know how many different plants have lily as part of their common name, most of which are not true lilies. And the daylily is, in fact, not a true lily. Lilies are lilium. There's probably more Hemerocallis in the world than liliums because it's an extremely popular perennial. But that's why I use the botanical name on the calendar in most cases.
I can imagine if we said butterfly bush, meaning Buddleia, we could be referencing butterfly bush, meaning that or that or that or that.
Yeah, butterfly shrub, butterfly weed, butterfly this, butterfly that. I mean, there's one of the salvias, Salvia spathacea, which has butterfly as part of its common name. Or no, hummingbird, that's another example of one that if it attracts it, you know, it gets that as part of the common name. Buddleia is a very large genus, and most people know Buddleia Davidii, the common butterfly bush. There's a bunch of others. It's a really interesting group of plants. And then Hemerocallis, that's daylilies, easily the most popular, easiest to grow perennial there is. I know you can grow them, I think, in all climate zones. I may be wrong about zones one or two, but I'm pretty sure you can grow them there too. Daylilies. It's a rhizome root. It's extremely easy to grow. You can divide them. It's actually easy to breed. So daylilies are like irises. Backyard hobbyists have hybridized them, not just big commercial enterprises. You can breed them yourself. And next year you can grow the seed and it'll often bloom the first year. You can see if you get something cool or interesting. So daylilies are just fun to grow. And there's places I understand where they've kind of naturalized. My grandmother's property in New York State, there were daylilies, and I thought they were native because I was a teenager and didn't know my plants that well. And I learned, no, she had just planted some and now they were everywhere. So there are some places where daylilies, they're beautiful, they're lovely, and they're incredibly easy to grow. I'll tell you something if you're listening locally. My experience, I've gone through daylily phases where I've been collecting them and planting them. They don't look best in blinding hot sun here. The plants look best if they're lightly shaded from the hottest sun of the day. Most of the places you grow them, that's not an issue. But I started, I had them all over the place when we first moved onto this property. And I started sort of digging them up and moving them to where they were gently shaded by a high deciduous tree. And the plants looked a lot better under those conditions. There's also a couple of daylilies that have come on the market that are just massively used in landscaping. Stella Doro, little dwarf yellow one, blooms, the joke is it blooms 362 days a year. It only takes a couple major holidays off. It is always in bloom, and it's a 1 foot tall, so it's not this big leafy thing that looks unsightly or ungainly, and bright yellow flowers and multiplies like crazy. I've seen it used essentially as a ground cover. It's an incredibly tough plant, so daylilies are very adaptable.
If that that ground cover daylily, wow. If plant is blooming all the time and it's short, so it's got more flower than leaf compared to regular ones, how is it surviving? Because wouldn't it be using up all its energy in those flowers? And would it just wither and die after a couple?
No, it increases, it multiplies, it makes up for its short stature with considerable vigor. And we all know people like that. So it's a very adaptable little one. It's in fact been used in breeding. There's a bunch of other dwarf daylilies. There's a daylily farm out here in Northern California, Amador Flower Farm out in Amador County. Yeah, we went out and had a nursery association meeting there about 20 years ago when they had first opened up. They had taken hundreds of Stella Doro, I don't know if this is still the case, and used them to just landscape a bank, a slope there as a ground cover. And they did comment that they would just mow them every now and then to clean them up. It's a very, very tough plant that just never stops blooming. So there's a bunch of versions. And there's daylilies where the flower spikes stand up 6 feet. So you've got a whole range of them. Huge flowers is the kind of thing you can really get into, like irises. You start getting the catalogs and going, look at this color, look at this bicolor. You get very excited. They're very, very easy to grow.
Two things, daylily and iris, and you can buy them off a catalog, but the pictures in the catalog are either spectacular if they've got someone with a great photographic skill, or they don't do justice to the plant. So I strongly recommend go and find one of these farms. Like there's an iris farm. When the irises are in bloom, you can go out, they give you a little checklist, you can go out and you can say, ooh, that one, and write it down. And then what you can do is you can order them, and they don't dig them up while they're blooming. They wait till the fall when it's appropriate. They'll dig up and send you the things that you ordered when you saw them. I don't know if the daylilies work exactly the same way. You might be able to take some of those home with you as you go, but seeing them in person is really, it's wonderful.
Well, a place like Amador Flower Farm has them in containers blooming as well as in the ground for you to admire. Of course, irises, there's an iris society in Sacramento and practically everywhere else. So that's the easy way to get inexpensive irises is to join the iris society. These are these perennials that grow just about anywhere. I mean, I saw one description of daylilies as America's favorite perennial. Don't know about that, but they're definitely grown everywhere, easy to grow everywhere, and actually kind of a fun thing for hobby breeders to do as well. So what else is on there? Oh, Gaillardia, that's on the May calendar. And here's a funny thing I was telling Lois before we came on. This picture I took of this particular Gaillardia called Goblin, it's a dwarf Gaillardia that we planted out front at our nursery, right under the pistachio ash tree right there along the sidewalk. I have a picture of that plant blooming every month of the year. that particular variety or Gaillardias in general or that unique situation, I have a picture of it blooming in December, January, June, July, you name it. This little guy is always
the same plant.
The same plant, yes. Also, that particular one, Goblin, seems to reseed and come true from seed, which is unusual for hybrids. So it may be just an open pollinated strain. I'm not sure. But it's a very easy one to grow. I think of Gaillardias as being midsummer daisies, sort of like Shasta daisy and echinaceas and rudbeckias and all that kind of thing, you know, your midsummer daisy flowers. But Gaillardias can bloom pretty much any month of the year, especially the variety called Goblin. And they're very, very easy to grow, generally full sun, but this one's getting some shade and it's actually fine with that. One thing that's on this list that has become increasingly popular, and you can look for these in garden centers now because they're in bloom, Mimulus.
That's sticky monkey flower, isn't it?
There is one. The native one is sticky monkey flower. The Mimulus and Diplacus are closely related. When I was a student, Diplacus was the woody versions of monkey flower. Mimulus were the herbaceous or soft-wooded types. They move back and forth. Taxonomists keep arguing about them, but they're all being sold now as monkey flower or Mimulus. And bigger companies have been hybridizing, coming out with varieties of our native monkey flower that are great garden plants. Whenever this happens, I'm always a little nervous that these garden varieties aren't going to be as long-lived or successful. We don't know for sure if all of this happened with Penstemon, for example, and I could rattle off a dozen other well-known perennials where the hybrids proved to be much shorter-lived, although more abundant bloomers than the original. But in the case of Mimulus, these seem to be long-lasting. They seem to be forming 2 to 3 foot shrubs. You can grow them pretty dry. Mimulus in general, or Diplacus in particular, monkey flowers can be drought-tolerant. Some are stream plants, but most of them are more drought-tolerant. And they're great garden plants, and many of them are close enough to native that you could put them in your native plant garden and enjoy the flowers and draw the hummingbirds and the other things that are attracted to the flowers. So look for some of these Mimulus. This is kind of new. There's a whole bunch of them on the market, really bright colors, oranges and reds and yellows, and a great addition to a relatively low water landscape. If you have a truly xeric landscape where you're doing California natives that you're not irrigating at all, I don't know if they would take that in the valley, but I'll bet you they would in the Bay Area or coastal parts of Southern California. So look for the monkey flowers. These are kind of a new thing, and they're proving to be good adaptable garden plants.
And the monkey flower, along with Brodea and a number of other things in the foothills near us, they bloom and grow and they do their thing in the spring, and they're never watered in the summer and they do fine.
Yes.
So you can take, I don't think they actually have garden tours for this. I took a class at the university on wildflowers, and as part of the class, the whole class went off taking trips together and looked at the flowers and things. So you might want to take a trip up into the foothills in spring and see what's there.
Well, there's actually some open areas in the Coast Range on our side of the valley as well. So it's been a good year for wildflowers here in California, thanks to all the rainfall. Now we're getting into the summer pattern. So, all right, what else did we have for today's?
I've got, I want to do this okra thing first, and then we'll get into list of questions you sent me. Yeah. This comes from Caitlin. Hi, Don and Lois. Can you give me some tips for growing okra? It's one of my favorite vegetables and hard to find in stores, so I've been trying to grow it myself for years. But so far, I've had a lot more failures than successes. My problem is that the little seedlings just dry up and die before they get their first or second true leaf. I've tried planting at various times, all the way from April to June, and both direct seeding and starting indoors. This is in gardens where other vegetables of all varieties are growing and surviving just fine. So is there anything special okra needs to get established? Thank you for your help. I love your show. And Caitlin is in Walnut Creek.
Okay, Walnut Creek is very similar climate to here in the valley. Okra is a tropical plant. Okra doesn't want to go into the ground. I'm going to be planting mine next week or this week, now that we're finally getting to 90 degrees, June. Yeah, May, Memorial Day weekend, June. It's one of the last things I plant, along with watermelon. These are plants that if they go into cold soil, they will not be happy. What that means, some plants that go into cold soil just sulk. They don't grow, but they don't die. Like you put your tomatoes in and, you know, you're not listening to the Davis Garden Show and you plant your tomatoes in February or March. They're not going to freeze, but they're not going to do anything because the soil is too cold. They're also not going to die, typically. They just sit there and they get kind of stunted. But some things, if they're truly tropical and it gets below 55 degrees, I mean, probably below 60 degrees, but below 55 degrees for sure, they'll be stunted to the point that they may be harmed and may even be killed. More to the point, it makes them vulnerable to water molds, which is our term for Pythium, Rhizoctonia, and Phytophthora, which are pathogens. They're not fungus, but they're fungus-like, that attack seedlings. They're the worst of our seedling disease problems in greenhouses. They are the seedling disease problems in greenhouses and indoors. And if the plant is stressed in any way, such as inadequate light, trying to start them indoors is a good example, such as very still and humid and moist conditions, again, indoors, you're going to have problems. They're going to be vulnerable. And the pathogen is present in soils, and particularly if you make your own soil mixes or have garden dirt in there, or you haven't cleaned your containers real well. Last step of washing containers, when I worked in the botany department of Botanical Conservatory, what was very important to avoid these kind of pathogens was we dipped the pots in a 5% bleach solution before we would dry them before we would use them again, if we use them again at all. Maybe just using new pots each time would be a way to prevent this problem. Buying soil mix rather than making your own, using essentially sterile media such as a mix of 50-50 peat moss and perlite, or coir and perlite, or peat moss and pumice, or something like that, something that doesn't naturally sustain pathogens, because most likely what you're seeing is a damping off disease. But it's also temperature related. So starting them in April or even early May this year would not have worked. The okra would have been very unhappy about it, because our night temperatures, we were 47 degrees just a few days ago at night. We were in the upper 30s 3 weeks ago here in the Sacramento Valley and Walnut Creek, probably fairly similar. We need a minimum night temperature of 55, and we're just getting there now. So this is the time to plant your okra. A greenhouse production of that kind of thing, they go into the warmest part of the greenhouse, and they don't even typically start them from the growers I order from until early to mid-May, because they come up very quickly. So my guess is that's what you're probably dealing with, just trying to plant them too early and running into damping off problems with your seedlings. That's what you're describing. Now, you can look closer at the seedlings and how they die, and damping off kills right at the ground level, and then the thing falls over and it just withers at that point. So that's the most common problem, is temperature related and then a pathogen attacking the plant because the seedling has been stressed by temperatures or low light conditions.
Do you find, Don, that in this particular plant, that in okra, it's a better bet if you can buy things in flats that are already past the two leaf stage?
Yeah.
They've made it past it, instead of trying to do from seed?
Yeah, because you, again, home gardeners don't have optimal conditions for growing things from seed. If you're doing it indoors, your light's too low, in which case you need to get up, you know, set up lights that are very close to the plant, very high intensity. You don't have air movement. In greenhouses, air exchange is carefully calibrated. I mean, you're taking classes in greenhouse management, airflow, air circulation, number of air changes per hour, et cetera, is built into the whole production system. You don't typically have that. Where we start things sometimes in our office, upstairs at our nursery, there's a little tiny fan, the kind that you plug into your computer. And we set this up a long time ago so that much of the day that little fan is running a few feet away from the seedlings and pointing towards them. Not a big fan. You don't want to dry them out, but you want air circulation. That greatly reduces damping off. So that right there might help. But we also have lights 6 inches above the seedling trays. And these are grow lights, 6 inches above the seedling trays. We have warm benches, warm pads, heating pads, which you can buy online. Companies like Greenhouse Megastore or AM Leonard Incorporated sell heating pads that are preset at 70 degrees. That makes a huge difference for any subtropical or tropical species, because the bottom heat is always there no matter what. Even if we, you know, turn off all the other heat in the building and leave for the night, we know at least underneath the seedlings they'll be 70 degrees. So that right there might make a difference. Her problem is the seedlings are dying, so it doesn't appear to be a germination issue. But once something comes up, we move as fast as we can to get it out of the seed germination station into the greenhouse. But we don't have a heated greenhouse. Ours are only passive. They're heated when the sun is shining. So we have to be very careful about things like okra. We just buy them in because of this. Watermelons, things like that. If the nights get cold, like they have here in the valley, you know, over the last 3 or 4 weeks, we've had temperatures in the greenhouses that were not acceptable for these truly tropical plants. You're not going to get real good results. So honestly, you'd probably do better. I have a conflict of interest here. We'd probably do better to go to a garden center and buy some okra than try to grow it from seed yourself. They heated their greenhouses. They made sure the conditions were optimal. You got a nice healthy plant ready to go, and then just don't plant too early. Okra loves heat. Something's going in right now. I'm about to plant okra and its cousin, the Roselle hibiscus, which is something I grow every year for tea. Those, I don't even bother putting them in the ground until we're basically about the 1st of June. And I suspect you'll do better off going to a garden center and buying them. We'll talk more about that hibiscus another time.
So if you think about it, the garden center has lost all of the things that are going to be lost. And it's past. Right. Don, sometimes you plant seeds and your success rate is 1% or less.
Yes, we wouldn't be growing them if we had that kind of success rate.
And so if you're buying okra that's already past that, it's 90 cousins that are gone.
Okay, let me clarify this. We don't get 90% failure rates on seedlings. We make sure that the conditions are favorable for germination and growth of the plant. So that, and what that really requires in the case of something like okra, if you're going to really try and start them in for sale in April or May, a heated greenhouse. That's the thing. And so they've done that for you. There's a lot, most people don't realize this, there's a lot of energy resources that go into the nursery industry. For me to have tomatoes to sell you in April, my grower started them in February. They obviously didn't do that outside. They did that in a heated greenhouse. Mm-hmm. And it's not passively heated, it's actively heated. So this is one of the things that frustrates me about places that are, wasting plants, bringing them in early and all that kind of stuff. A lot of resource went into that. So keep that in mind. But the big advantage that the grower of something like okra has is they can maintain that bottom heat. They can maintain that air temperature where it needs to be. That's very hard for you to do as a home grower. People who really get into starting things from seed, which can be a good way to save money in gardening, they typically have a light setup and they have it in a room that's warm. And in some cases, they even have bottom heat pads. Yeah, there are some things where I think it's probably worth just buying the okra plant in your case, because you don't have those facilities. You don't have a way to set that up. I've done it many times at my home and it involves bottom heat, lights above, and shuttling the plants outside in the day for that air movement that we want to, keep them sturdy and also reduce disease problems, and then bring them back in at night because it's going to be too cold for them. So there's some that are really easy. Tomatoes are easy from seed. There's some that are really slow. Peppers are really slow from seed. They're a hassle for us, much less home gardeners. And there's some that are easy if you just wait long enough. And some of them, things like beans, we can stick a bean in a pot and sell that plant 8 days later. Okay, it doesn't take a lot of resources to get you a nice little bean seedling. Squash, melons, cucumbers, things like that. So things are variable as to how easy they are from seed. My guess is you're struggling with the seedling disease problem, and part of it is starting them too early.
And I know we're stuck on okra, but just in general, yeah. If I want to plant a vegetable from seed, mm-hmm. Like can I take okra seeds and just go out in the yard and stick them in the dirt?
You can in theory. Now this is where most of my customers in most of my experience has been that seedlings right out in the garden, there's lots of things that can go wrong. That's the problem. Unless you're out there at night watching all the things that are marauding through your garden and enjoying those little tender seedlings. Direct seeding, there are some things like corn. Most people direct seed it. I actually transplant corn myself for the same reason as the others, that I have a lot of things that come in and think a nice seedling of corn that just sprouted was something I did for them. So I obviously planted that so they get a salad bar.
Live in the country, it's slightly different when you're in the city. Yes. Slightly different. Yes. I mean, you might have the same insect diseases, but you probably have fewer species of mammals coming around and digging.
I have more species of mammals, yes, than you would in town.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Okay, let's move on. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, that's an interesting segue. We were going to briefly talk about this. Last week, I think it was, someone was talking about something digging in their yard. And yes. We concluded it was probably skunks or possums. I mentioned that I had topped off over a dozen containers in my backyard with my really fancy organic potting soil that has, that has all sorts of nutrients in it, and gone out the next morning, and every pot that I had topped off, something had dug pretty deep in the pots. And I allowed as how it might be.
Awesome. They throw out manure. You have to have a chicken under there somewhere.
Something they were poking around, and I was thinking, you know, birds could have been doing it, squirrels could have been doing it, possums, skunks. So these were the options we discussed. Well, I caught him at it. It was my fox.
It was your fox.
Yes, and he had hopped up into each one of those and smelled something, and so dug around down there.
Chicken, John.
Yeah, and then he had gone over and curled up on top of a pepper in another planter, and that's where he was when I came out in the yard sleeping, and I disturbed him. I'm awfully sorry. Sleeping on top of one of my pepper plants in a nice, warm, big planter that's in full sun. So, all right, he and I can coexist. That's fine. I just smoothed out the pots and watered them, and he went on his way. Here's the thing. He hasn't come back to do that again. He's back in the yard. I see him every day. But he hasn't been digging again. They only continue to dig in your pot or in your lawn or something if there's a reward there. They're exploring the first time. If they don't find something, they're not going to come back and keep doing it. If they do find grubs or earthworms or something, which that's all fine. That's a sign of a healthy soil. But they'll probably keep coming back. So to the person who sent in the question, the concerns about this, in that instance, you do need to put some kind of a barrier down. But I would suggest, as with most pest problems, monitor first, because it may just be a one-time thing. Yeah, he checked every container, but he hasn't been back to any of them because there was nothing there. So my guess is it's a one-time thing in his case, and we have a good relationship, so I'm not concerned about it. But if they're coming back day after day, then you probably have worms or grubs, and grubs are very common, grubs of different types of beetles. And while they're doing you a favor, perhaps, by eating the grubs, it's not such a great favor to be digging in your pots or in your lawn. So you may have to put a barrier over it. In general, with animal pests, making it harder for them to do whatever they're doing, they'll just move along. I'll give you one other example. Tree squirrels have found the farms in Dixon. They weren't here 20 years ago, but they finally arrived here 4 or 5 years ago. We have a few tree squirrels on the property. I'm not thrilled about it, but they can't really seem to get large numbers here because it's mostly an orchard. And interestingly, orchards are a challenge for tree squirrels. They're too open. But they were making a run between several of the larger trees on my property. I could watch them. It's entertaining, but also sort of infuriating as they go from the oak to the walnut to the this to the that. My son sharpened the chainsaw and was doing some work on the property and went ahead and cut off one fairly major limb of my big old pecan, because we've been meaning to take that off for quite a while. It's completely disrupted the runway of the tree squirrels. Just removing this one branch that they were using to make the leap from the walnut to the pecan to the oak, we watch them arrive at the pecan and back up and not know what to do because we've broken up their runway. So if you're having a problem with tree squirrels or roof rats, which I call tree rats, coming in, look at what the logical runway is that they're using to get to your orange or your fig or your plum, and do whatever you can to stymie that. It can be as simple as putting carpet tack stripping on the top of your fence. It can be pruning the trees a little bit away from each other so it's harder to jump from tree to tree, so they're out in the open when they have to run from tree to tree. Cover the trees if you have to during the fruiting period. This is a conversation with someone who's already got squirrels knocking their unripe plums off their tree and they're not even close to ripe yet. Said, well, you can cover it temporarily, at least, so that they can't get on there and do that. Just make it harder for them because they want to move quickly. They need cover. They need someplace where they can hide while they're doing the damage to your tree. So just do a little strategic pruning and make the runways more difficult. It's that simple. You know, I'm not saying this is going to solve everything, but make it so they'd rather go to your neighbor's plum tree than yours.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And when you see that tree rat running along the wire,
yeah, you can't take the wire out.
No. And you can't even get up there and put one of those aluminum pie plates with a hole in the middle wrapped around so that it that stops them from going. It can't even do that. So
the tree rats and the roof rats, as they're called, they don't want to be open to the sky at all. I mean, I have plenty of them on our farm.
We have hawks here.
Right, hawks and owls in particular. Owls at night, and they're all moving around at night. If the damage is happening during the daytime, it's tree squirrels. If it's happening at night, it's tree rats or roof rats. And the squirrels are much more aggressive and don't even care if you're out there. But it does work, by the way, to run at them and flail at them and wash them off with water or whatever you're okay with. We have them in our nursery yard, and we just make sure we aggressively chase them off the nursery yard if they start to come in. The rats, if they're open to the sky, they want to keep moving because they don't want to be exposed to these night flying predators. So they have to have a place where they can harbor. That's why they're such a problem sometimes on citrus, because the whole citrus tree is dense enough that they can get in there, spend 20, 30 minutes eating out the inside of an orange. You know, that takes a while. Eating the peels off the kumquat, which I've actually had them do on my property. So if you're having that problem, just making it harder for them to get there, even thinning out the tree a little bit to make it more open, can actually make a surprisingly big difference. Make them a little more uncomfortable about hanging out in your yard. Now, flipping this around, we were talking about bringing in the good birds, mockingbirds and blue jays. And right after we did that program a couple weeks ago, I went out and I was waiting for the program to download and all this stuff. And I found this old casserole, the kind of thing you'd roast an entire chicken in, that we had used for years as a water bowl for an old dog who used to live out there, a different dog. And I thought, well, I have a dog-like critter coming through my yard. It's getting dry. This dog-like critter might actually enjoy some water. So I cleaned it out. I set it down. I filled it with water. And I'm walking away. I'm not even at the back door when a mockingbird lands on the fence 6 feet away, looks at me, flies right over my shoulder, lands on that water bowl casserole, and starts screaming. And spent the rest of the morning screaming, essentially establishing, I gather, its territory. I don't think like a mockingbird, but that's what it seemed like to me. And spent the rest of the day flailing in the water, drinking the water, and has now taken up residence nearby and sitting up on top of a pole and screaming its head off and singing beautifully, sort of alternating between those things because there's a little water supply there. So one of the simplest things you can do is bring in a water bowl that they can land on. This is a casserole, so it had a handle built into it that it could land on and get purchased with those big feet they have. And now my backyard is its territory. It's pretty easy to tell if you've drawn mockingbirds or jays into your yard. They make their presence known and they will eat all those bugs. So this kind of wildlife, well, I did it for the fox, it's obviously of benefit to certain other wildlife coming through as well.
I'm clairvoyant. I can picture what you did and I can say, and he put that out in the open.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Right? Yes.
And that's the key. Only those bold birds, like the mockingbirds, are going to come out in the open and drink. Right. If you wanted to get water to the birds that are a little more shy, you would take that sort of thing and tuck it underneath the edge of a bush. Right. So that they could be like 6 inches from a bush when they're out there drinking. Yep. We have a bird bath outside our kitchen window, and it's tucked in there. Part of it, there's open sky too, but there's bushes really close. We get all sorts of stuff in there.
And the big guys come in, they don't care. If I'm in the backyard, they just look at me and squawk again.
Well, yeah. And
you'll have to work it out with the fox.
Our bird bath, the scrub jay, which thankfully doesn't come very often, when it comes, it plops down in the middle of the thing, takes a bath, and it leaves, and there's no water left.
That's right.
Because it's such a big bird, and it's so splashy, and it's like, okay, the jay was here. We better go fill it up again.
So this is a lead-in to a couple of comments and questions that I got during the week. Because the reason we're telling you to bring in these birds to the best ability you have is that they are extraordinarily good predators of certain types of pests. So on the list of questions I sent you,
recent pictures brought in of major hatching events of red-humped caterpillars. Red-humped caterpillars. You say that.
Red-humped caterpillars.
How can you do that? And leaf-footed bugs. That I can say. But both of these are things that are, they're in one spot when they hatch out and then they disperse rapidly.
Yeah, right. In early May, typically, and for a little, in the case of the leaf-footed bugs and some of the other bugs, stink bugs and squash bugs and all that crowd, and all the way through the month of May and into June, red-humped caterpillars. I've seen pictures being posted on the California Native Plant Society page, and someone brought me, and then someone else sent me a picture. This all happens within like a 3 to 5 day period. I figure it's happening everywhere. So let's talk briefly about those two. Andrew was listening, is a longtime listener. listener, and he came in with a picture of a whole bunch of leaf-footed bugs that had just hatched out. When they just hatch, it's a little hard to tell them as leaf-footed bugs because the little flange thing on their leg or foot isn't as visible as it becomes as they get bigger, but it's there, it's present. Leaf-footed bugs are common. Interestingly, 20, 25 years ago, maybe once or twice during the course of a summer, someone would bring one in and ask me about it. Now it's all summer long. Why? Well, one of their favorite crops is almonds. Okay. And we have thousands and thousands and thousands of acres of almond trees in the area. And they actually do a lot of damage to almonds, interestingly, because they have a powerful proboscis that they can push into the young green almond before it's hardened up, you know, while it's still developing, and push in there and insert a little enzyme that liquefies the almond stuff and drink it, and as much as 3-5% of the almonds can be destroyed by a bad infestation of leaf-footed bug in an almond orchard. So almond growers are concerned about it. Moreover, as with many of our pest problems here in the valley, what is an agricultural pest becomes a home garden pest just because of the changing in cropping patterns in the area. And we certainly have many, many thousands of acres of almonds. And even though summer coming out, there's still plenty there. And so the leaf-footed bug is a pest of almonds. It also can be a pest for home gardeners of pomegranates. And Andrew has a beautifully espaliered pomegranate. Actually, someday I'll post a picture of this. It's an astonishing tree. But what they do with pomegranates, you wouldn't think any insect could poke its proboscis through into a pomegranate through that tough skin, but indeed they can. And they get in there and they get the juice out of one of the little red arils, the fleshy part around the seed. So when you open a pomegranate that's been infested, pretty good chance you'll just find a few of those little arils that are desiccated and no good, and the rest of it will probably be fine. However, sometimes they inadvertently make an opening or insert some bacteria or fungus in there that causes the fruit to rot. And so you'll open up your pomegranate, the whole thing is spoiled and rotten on the inside. So that's a bit of the damage that leaf-footed bugs can do. When I would give talks on gardening for wildlife, I would show a picture one of my staff people took probably about 15 years ago, of a single pomegranate fruit with about 50 leaf-footed bugs right on the fruit. And people, the audience would always go, "Ugh!" And she also pointed out there are at least 50 more fruit on the tree that were completely unaffected. This is one of those insects that congregates. When you have one, you got a bunch of them. The picture Andrew showed me had 30, I don't know, a couple dozen at least, all in one place on a vine. That's where they were happening to be hatching. So they're pretty easy to control because they're all together in one place. Either, you know, if you're going to spray them with something, I suppose you could do that. But more typically, these are the kind of pests where you take a bucket, some water, a little soap in it, tap them into the soapy water, and that's that, and they'll fall right in. And so, and they're all in one place, so it's very convenient to do. They're pretty easy to mechanically control that way just by, you know, putting them into a wet soapy solution. They don't generally do a bunch of other damage in the garden, but they do go to tomatoes and peaches, certain other fruits. If they've attacked a tomato as it's in the expansion stage, you'll often find just a little area on the fruit. You've probably never even noticed it. So the damage is mildly cosmetic. A commercial grower would be not real thrilled about it, but you as a home gardener have probably never even noticed the damage they do. Unless you get a whole bunch of them on there and the fruit is still small, in which case that fruit won't develop properly. I've never actually seen that, but it can happen on peaches as well. More commonly, they disperse into the garden, and if you have a good population of mockingbirds or jays, that'll be the end of them.
So how do they taste? Are these one of the bitter bugs that the bird will go, ooh?
No, they're more in the stink, they're in the stink bug category. So there's a lot of things that probably don't eat them, but I can tell you jays and mockingbirds, or certainly mockingbirds do. And then the red hump caterpillar. Now, that's another one. If you find the eggs before they've hatched, they're all neatly lined up, perfect little geometric precision on the underside of a leaf. And the species that I have typically seen them on are walnuts, cherries, and redbuds, including our native western redbud. When they hatch, it becomes a bit more of a frothy mess, and it sort of looks like a thing of foam. But if you look closely, you'll realize that they're all little eggs that have hatched. Red hump caterpillars begin feeding immediately, but they're very tiny, of course, and they all hatch at once. So you get a whole lot of damage, very localized, and they're so small, they're only able to feed between the veins of the leaf So the first thing you see is skeletonized leaves. So you notice the leaf looks kind of transparent. it, you'll look more closely, you're seeing that there are holes between the veins, and of course you'll probably find caterpillars present. If they're not all eaten off early on by various predators, they can eat an awful lot of foliage very quickly. When I was establishing our walnut orchard a number of years ago, we had repeated infestations of red hump caterpillar, which you could tell because one whole branch would be defoliated. Not all over the tree. They don't disperse that way. They move out like a little army, moving down the leaf and then down that branch. Pretty easy to find, pretty easy to control if you catch them in time, just by literally snipping off the part where they're infesting, bagging it, and disposing of it. But the way I would normally be able to tell that I had an infestation in my young walnut orchard was by the screaming of the mockingbirds and jays down at that end of the orchard, because they would fly in right away and take control. And in fact, the picture that someone sent me of the egg mass, there were no caterpillars present. So there was damage. There were the old hatched eggs, but no caterpillars. Well, your problem has obviously solved itself, because these guys don't crawl away very far or very fast. They start feeding immediately. If you're not finding caterpillars, don't worry about it. And in general, with red hump caterpillars, I would say, don't worry about it. Now, a young redbud could be completely defoliated by them. I have a customer who goes through this every year with her redbud. Yeah, it's not great for the tree to lose all the leaves, but usually they'll put on a whole new crop of leaves. Usually they'll continue growing just fine. Usually you don't need to worry about it. And many people who are growing native plants, one of the things they're growing them for is their role in the whole ecosystem. And caterpillars feeding on your plant are part of that. I hate to say that. It's not terribly aesthetic, but the birds feeding on the caterpillars is an important part of why you're growing native plants. So would you spray for it? I wouldn't. Ever, but some people might be concerned enough about a young redbud, or particularly redbud is one I'm thinking of here. I would monitor. If you see the problem, just pick those caterpillars off. Seriously, if they're on a leaf, you pick off that leaf, you throw it into the nearby bushes. Hate to say it, that's the end of those caterpillars. So you don't really have to worry about spraying. If you absolutely wanted to spray, there is, of course, the very specific spray that'll kill caterpillars, the organic BT-based sprays. But think about whether your plant is big enough to sustain some injury, some cosmetic injury, without really being a problem. In general, as with so many things, monitoring, seeing how bad it gets, mechanical removal, only going to even an organic pesticide as a last option. And in most cases, by the time you get down to the store and buy it, your problem has solved itself, thanks to the jays and mockingbirds.
Three people in one day came in asking if they need to be concerned about squash, pumpkins, and melons hybridizing in the garden.
Yeah, cucurbitaceae is the family of the squash, melons, pumpkins, cucumbers. They're all in the same family, cucurbitaceae, cucurbits. And they can interhybridize within certain groups within that family, which only matters if you're saving the seed. If you're growing an heirloom squash and you want to make sure that the seeds of that heirloom squash are going to be exactly like the parent, then you hand pollinate it and then you bag the flower so it won't get cross-pollinated by a bee bringing pollen over from another nearby related species and inadvertently causing the progeny, the babies, the seedlings you grow next year to be affected. It won't affect the squash you're eating. Even if the pollen got on there and the seed is not what you want, the zucchini will still be a zucchini. The pumpkin will still be a pumpkin. There's only one case where it actually matters. Corn. If you plant sweet corn and the field around you is full of popcorn or field corn, a fair number of the kernels on your sweet corn are going to be chewy and highly starchy and not very sweet. You may notice on the seed packet, some of them will tell you that they need to be isolated from each other. Squash, pumpkins, melons, yes, they can cross. No, it doesn't matter unless you're trying to save the seed. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.